I'm Candace Cable. I'm 65. Today's date is November 1st, 2019. We are in a Broadmoor suite in Colorado Springs, Colorado, and it's a pretty sweet suite. And my partner is Aaron Popovich, and our relationship is that we're both Paralympians, and we just became classmates for the 2019 Hall of Fame. I was a Paralympic athlete in the sports of wheelchair racing, downhill skiing, cross-country skiing. I competed in 9 Paralympic Games, 4 summer and 5 winter. I was a medalist 14 times. 2 of them are in Olympic exhibition events. And my placement in my events is all over the place, I'm going to have to say.
I'm Aaron Popovich. I am 34 years old today. The date is November 1st, 2019. We are in the beautiful Colorado Springs, Colorado, and I'm here with Candace Cable, who is a fellow 2019 inductee to the USOPC Hall of Fame. I'm a Paralympic swimmer. I competed in the 2000, 2004, and 2008 Paralympic Games in swimming, where I won 14 gold and 5 silver. All right, so I'll start us off today, Candace. I'm looking forward to this and just hearing more about you, since I know we're fellow classmates, but we haven't had a lot of time to interact with each other because we're all over in the world.
Right.
So you've been involved with Paralympic sports for a very long time, but how would you accurately describe each of the sports that you were involved in?
I have to say, too, I'm pretty excited by this. It feels really intimate. I'm a StoryCorps fan, so this is one of those highlights I'll put if I ever write a book in there. So my sports that I got involved with, first, I wasn't an athlete before I had a spinal cord injury in 1975 at the age of 21. And as I was going to university, I wanted to meet other people with disabilities at Disabled Student Services. And some sports were being invented at the time in about 1977. One of them was wheelchair racing. And I was hanging out with the people that were inventing the sport. So I became part of a small group of people in the U.S., and there was people in Europe that were doing this too, evolving the sport of wheelchair racing into, from our 50-pound stainless steel Everest and Jennings wheelchairs, yeah, our dinosaurs, into the sleek little mini dragsters, I like to call them now, that are 3 wheels, and they just look so fast, and they are. So it was social to get involved with the sport for me, with wheelchair racing, and a need to be connected to other people like me. And then in 1988, after a very successful Paralympic Games for me in the summer, a friend of mine said, hey, they've got this sport, downhill skiing. I bet you'd be really good at it. And I had tried skiing just before I had my spinal cord injury, and I really liked it, but I figured I was never going to do that again. And so I went up to Truckee, Tahoe, California, and took 2 weeks of lessons. That's kind of my MO. I immerse myself in things. It's like, I'm going to see if I like this. And I was good at it right away because I was a good athlete already. So I think that's a great crossover when you're already an athlete at something, that it's easy to pick stuff up because we already have that mindset. And I fell in love with it. I was going through a divorce at the time, and I thought, oh, I need to relocate. So I moved up to the Truckee, Tahoe area and lived up there for 25 years and took up downhill skiing and skied 1 Paralympic turn with that in 92 and switched to cross-country skiing because I really liked the aerobic sport, which was similar to wheelchair racing, and competed in Paralympics with that. So that was my path.
Awesome. And,
yeah.
That's incredible.
I know. It was a I wanted to ask you a question about this because any sacrifices you felt like that you made when you were competing? Because I think a lot of people talk about sacrifice, and I personally never felt like that. It felt like a path. And I want to hear from you because you started so young. I want to hear like your path and if you felt like you made sacrifices.
I think with everything in life, there's sacrifices that we are either conscious that we're making or subconscious. And for me, I was fortunate in that when I started, they actually said I was really late to the sport, but I was still 11 years old and figuring out how to do more than the doggy paddle. But I think, and I have to attribute so much to my parents when I was younger, is that they really didn't pressure me into becoming an elite athlete in swimming when I was young. It was more just fun and do it. But if I was going to do the sport of swimming, they were going to hold me accountable to it too. I'm sure there's times when, you know, I would have much rather gone and hang out with friends or do, you know, the after school stuff, but swimming was a priority for me. But growing up, I did all of the sports. We were a soccer family. Every weekend we'd drive all over the state of Montana, traveling to soccer tournaments with my brother and sister. And so for a long time, our whole family was soccer. And so I did have to give that up once swimming kind of took over and I saw more potential and future in that. But then as you grow up, I was in high school, still swimming, and then moved on to college. And I think for me, I was surrounded by a lot of people who had the same goals and dreams as myself. So it didn't always feel like a sacrifice in terms of what I was giving up, because the people around me were of similar goals and mindsets, which was very helpful. But then at the same time, there's a lot of, whether it was a family function that everybody got together to hang out, and, you know, I either had a meet or something else going on that, so I couldn't be there. And so there was some of those sacrifices, and I know my family sacrificed a lot for me in order to make me be able to go to swim meets. I mean, swim meets are not the most wild and crazy thing to watch on your Saturday and Sundays, but, you know, they made sure that I got to where I needed to go. And so that was, so I think whether we realize it or not, we're always making sacrifices. It's just how much emphasis we put on that, and can we maybe take that opportunity to make it more, you know, later, whether it's with family and making the time that you do have more valuable. And so I think it varies. I think it's hard to say, like, I don't think there's one specific thing, but when you have a goal or you have a strong will or mindset, I think some things you just have to change and adapt, and that becomes the new norm.
Yeah, I agree with you on that, the change and adapt. Did you swim with your high school swim team? And with your dwarfism that you were born with, did that affect that at all?
So for me, I grew up in Butte, Montana, a very small town, and I went to a small high school. And so my freshman year, I think it was myself and one or two other girls that were the school swim team, and we actually partnered with the other high school in town for practices and everything. And so I did swim my freshman year, I believe, as part of the high school team. And then for us, it was just going to be me after that for the remainder years. So I just stayed with the club team instead, which was at the same pool. So for me, it was interesting. I got to go and swim at the meets and stuff, but I think it was just, I looked at a lot of these opportunities as just more opportunities to gain experience, and that every race is a little bit different, and there's never going to be anything that's identical. You know, it's a pool. You know that the pool is there. You know that there's going to be officials and call rooms and this and that, but there's always the unpredictable. So I kind of took it as an opportunity to be able to race and compete wherever I could so that I gained that experience, and you learn to take the outside factors and learn how to deal with them. So that was kind of, I didn't get a whole lot of high school swimming experience, but at the same time, you know, swimming is an individual sport as much as it is a very much a team sport. And so I think for me, I could swim in my lane and race against the clock more than anything in those high school meets, and And that became a drive for me to really lower the bar with times. All right. So you talked a lot about the track and field and how when you were, after your injury, you were fortunate to be surrounded by people who are really kind of inventing and creating the sport as it is. Can you talk a little bit how you think the technology with especially a sport as track and field or wheelchair racing, but even in Nordic, has changed throughout your time when you first started into now? I mean, it's incredible what they're able to do nowadays.
Yes, the equipment is, especially the three sports that I competed in, is essential, right? There was always this feeling that you didn't want to get beat by your equipment.
Absolutely.
Right. It didn't fall apart or you were behind on the technology. And so for me, because I started so much at the beginning, I was a part of a group of people in Southern California. And we created a little team called the Southern California Flyers. And we would mess around with our daily chairs to see if we could make them lighter. But there were some rules on the track that you still had to have certain things on your wheelchair. One was push handles, which didn't make any sense at all, but it was part of the rule book, right? So we had to begin to do things that would challenge the rule book to advance the technology. So we would race with cutting the push handles off, but we attached them someplace else because they were still there. And then they saw how ridiculous it was and they changed the rule. Yeah. Yes. So there were that kind of things. And then there was this guy, Jeff Minnebraker, who coupled with Brad Parks, who really invented wheelchair tennis with Jeff and John Chambers, and then Mary Wilson Bogle, as well as Eric Walls, got together and they created a company called Quadra. And they were the very first lightweight daily chairs, which helped the evolution of our racing chairs. So the four of them were mad scientists in a garage cutting up metal and welding things on and creating these lighter chairs that we could use in our daily lives. So we were moving away from the 50-pound chairs because those were the first chairs we tried to race in. And then we started to change the shape of those. And so we started out with four wheels, just like a standard wheelchair, because I use a wheelchair for mobility. And so we had 8-inch wheels on the front, the regular 24-inch wheels on the back. And we made the push ring smaller to see if we could create more speed with a smaller push ring. Wow. And the push ring is traditionally used to push the wheel, right, to move the chair. So we would go smaller, a little smaller. And then we started getting a little bit bigger wheels on the front of the chair that we were trying to race in. And then we started to realize that four wheels wasn't that stable because all of us were starting to do road races. We were jumping in 5Ks and 10Ks and marathons. And there was no wheelchair division. So we got together, formed the International Wheelchair Road Racers Club. And that was across the country and from people from Europe. And we created guidelines and rules for race directors to integrate wheelchair divisions into road races. And once we started working with them and we started getting in road races, we started going faster than we did on the track. We started to realize how unstable our four wheels were. But the rule said you still had to have four wheels. So we started building these chairs that had three wheels with a little tiny, tiny wheel attached to the front for a fourth wheel. And then, of course, that eventually changed.
Right.
I know. I think we looked pretty interesting going down the road doing some of these things. But and I think a lot of non-disabled people didn't even notice, really. But we all were making, you know, laughing and making little jokes about it because we had to use four wheels, but we were going for three. And we realized three wheels was way more stable. And so that was the metamorphosis of the three-wheel chair. And then the front end started to get extended as well as a little steering device that was super complicated in the beginning to try to control the front wheel with the way that the road – so roads are crowned. Mm-hmm. So water will run off of it. And road races, running races, wheelchair division are in the road. So what will happen is that the chair had – going down the road wanted to go towards the curb all the time. So someone was using their outside arm to try to keep going straight. So we invented these little devices called steering devices that would keep the front wheel stiff so that it wanted to go straight. And we could adjust that with a little lever. And eventually that got adapted for the track, because the faster we went around the track, the more centrifugal force wanted to throw us out. And to create equity in classes, because they were trying to combine, as they always are with our classes in Paralympic sport, we needed to create something that was going to create that equity and that everyone could use and be able to hold the turn as well as the straight without trying to use your body to do it. So let the technology do it. So that was pretty massive. That was a massive change for the track. And we went from 8 classes on the track to 4. Wow. Which, that's a pretty big jump.
Yeah. That's huge.
Yeah. So I had the privilege of being a part of that advancement. And I think the technology in sport and wheelchair racing that I'll talk about changed the technology of our daily chairs too. And access. Yeah. And I think that it also contributed to when the Americans with Disabilities Act was being pushed forward. I think our sports and our advocacy in sport was a contributor to the overall advocacy of our civil rights that were being developed in the 1990 ADA. Yeah.
That's
incredible. Yeah, it was super cool. But there was some strife, you know, within the advocacy groups, because oftentimes people would say, well, you athletes don't really represent disability. And he says, no, it's part of the human life experience. Sport is.
Yeah. I think that's an interesting point that you bring up, is that, yes, there's many individuals here within the United States with some varying degree of physical impairment or disability. Mm-hmm. And I know that there's severe disabilities, there's minor, there's the full spectrum of individuals. And so I think it's very interesting that they use that and they spoke to that, because I think we have disabilities, but we're promoting life over our disability. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting how people, I've recently had a similar conversation of, well, you don't really understand because you're not a typical dwarf, because you're very athletic, and I'm very blessed to be athletic, but just like in the, I call them able-bodied or average world, you know, there's the full spectrum of athletes within that realm as well. And not every male is going to be the Michael Phelps or, you know, Carl Lewis or any of these phenomenal athletes that we do have, but there's a wide range. And I think that's what helps push forward, a more, hopefully, you know, centralized or equal way of promoting, you know, the things that we are trying to accomplish and trying to move forward, whether it's, you know, the Disabilities Act in 1990 or you know, some of the programs that we have out there even today. And we're showing, you know, we're very blessed in that we're both phenomenal athletes. I mean, you accomplished so much as well. And I was blessed with a great career as well. And so I think, you know, you have to push the margins of what athletes can do, and what, no matter if you have a spinal cord injury or you're an amputee or any of the athletes with disabilities, there's really a whole nother world out there. And so we want to continue to push it forward. And I think that's honestly one of the awesome parts about sport, is that it's such an, I won't say an equalizer, but it promotes, you know, so much positivity and camaraderie, and, you know, it's an avenue for kids to get out and play sports and interact with others that they may not have seen or known about before. And it's, as we continue to move forward, you're now seeing commercials with athletes playing in wheelchairs and, or wheelchair basketball or other sports. And so it's really incredible to see just how much, you know, athletes in sport can transcend across a whole nation and even the world.
Oh, and I love, you know, what you said and the, you know, the riff kind of direction that we're going, because there is no traditional representation of a human being.
Exactly. Right?
There isn't. And the way you said that was so great. And it really is about creating equity, right? Whether it's for women or people of color, African Americans, LGBTQA+, people with disabilities, anything. It's really about, I think, and you said it so well too, is that it's about authentic representation of that what the human life experience is. And in the teaching that I do around understanding disability, one of the things I try to get across to the people I'm mostly teaching are non-disabled people that are trying to learn about it so they can create integration and inclusion in whatever area, be it employment or in sport, or they don't realize that disability is a human life experience we will all have, mm-hmm. that we all go that direction, because if nothing else, aging, if we're blessed to live long enough, aging is going to get us one way or another.
Can't stay forever young.
We could, like, the hearing loss or vision loss, or which are two of the ones that I think most people can identify with, and embrace that as this experience that is a part of the human life cycle, and as you said before, and so in those early days when there was this kind of back and forth where they would say, oh, yeah, you're super Crips, you know, inspiration porn, you don't represent. We would say exactly what you said, is that we do represent, and there is this wide range of the human experience. And that's why it's important to really embrace all of it. And I remember when and this is more recent, the Convention on Rights for Persons with Disabilities, the United Nations document, human rights document, mm-hmm. that was written and then started to be signed in 2008, I think, or 2006, that before that, disability was not mentioned in any human rights documents other than a condition. We Wow. weren't individuals. We weren't people. We were objects. We weren't subjects. And that was also present in our human rights, our civil rights documents from the 1960s in this country. People with disabilities were left out of those. So that's why the Rehabilitation Act was written, 504, and that's why ADA came forward. I mean, lots of advocates say that's our Emancipation Proclamation, basically. It says, yeah, people with disabilities have rights. But when the CRPD, the Convention on Rights for Persons with Disabilities, was signed in, there was a lot of work to try to get our Congress to ratify it. And so one of the organizations, U.S. International Council on Disability, came to me and said, we want to use athletes to try to get the word out, because you all are very visible. You're kind of sexy, too. And people love the medals. So we talked about it, and I put together a group of athletes, and we went to Capitol Hill with all the other advocates, and we started banging on the doors of our senators and our representatives to see if we could meet with them to talk about the CRPD and ratifying. And we were the only group that got meetings with senators and our Wow. representatives. The rest of them were staff meetings.
Yeah.
And it's because they wanted to see our medals. And our medals were the platform to get in the door. And I think it was it Lisa Leslie last night that said about kicking the door open?
Or yeah, absolutely.
We kicked it wide open. We did. We pushed it wide open, and we got to get them to listen. And when the final votes started to come down, we ended up not getting ratification by only 5 votes.
Oh my gosh,
which
so close.
Was so close. And we are one of 4 countries in the world now that hasn't ratified that human rights document that's really based on our ADA. But so, you know, the idea that we have as athletes something to offer that is different and can add to the, I don't know, the quilt, the yeah. human quilt, right? Yeah, is really, really powerful. And I think now in advocacy, especially with disability movement, I think people are starting to realize that. And Yeah.
That's incredible. I mean,
I know it's pretty cool, like, right?
Pioneer, not only in track and field and all the other sports, but then, I mean, in terms of legislature, wow, like the politics. I mean, I wish, you know, it could just say this is, we need to do this and this is how it's going to be done. But
right.
I guess that's not how politics work, as we are well aware of it in today's society. But I think it's so crazy to think how simple language that in today's world we don't even really consider as needing to call out necessarily, because, I mean, we're here today and I just see you as a person. I don't see you as a wonderful woman in a wheelchair. And so I think it's fascinating to see how people have moved so much further forward in life and in interacting with people and in their daily lives and the new norm, yet we still have these old doctrines and legislator that say, that don't even really recognize us yet. But I'm sure that hopefully will be something that's coming.
Oh my gosh, here's a mind blower for you. So just before the Americans with Disabilities Act was written and signed by our president, our Congress exempt themselves from it.
Really?
Total mind blow, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. So that's when you, so that's like when you go up on Capitol Hill, there's not an accessible bathroom on every floor.
Wow.
The doorways are sometimes too narrow to get to or get through into offices because they don't have to do it. And I think that's one of the issues that's, I think, kind of a problem with the Americans with Disabilities Act. And don't get me wrong, I'm super grateful for it. And we can change it.
There's a lot of good in it.
Yeah, there's a ton of good.
It's not perfect.
Yeah, and we can change that, right? That's, we can make amendments and those kind of things. But one of the things is that it doesn't have a lot of teeth. And a lot of non-disabled people in this world don't understand how it personally affects them. They don't get that disability is a human life experience. And we need to create equity. We need to create access for everyone because you're going to need it.
Right.
Like, you're going to need it, you're going to need it, you're going to need it. You just want to deny it right now. And I think in the forcing of people to do things, there's resistance, right? Like, yeah. It says, you got to do this.
Well, change is difficult, and change takes a lot of work. It's,
yeah.
You know, if we wanted to change something and it was easy, then, man, we'd be all over the board, I think. But
But
change takes a lot of work.
I think so. And I think we can take some of the work out of it when we realize our personal stake in it, right?
Yeah.
I think that when we realize the change is actually going to be a really good thing for us, then we're more amenable to do it, right? And we have a bigger stake in it. I mean, I think, you know, when I think about discrimination in this country, I think about people of color and racism and our systemic systems that are dividing us that exist, and how important it is to be an ally for people of color. Even though I'm a white woman and I have privilege because I'm white, that I discovered that it's important for me to become an ally for people of color to dismantle racism in this country and the systems that promote racism. And so that's what I want other people to do for disability and the movement, is to become an ally for us too and see where our stake in is. And like, I'm not a person of color. And so I can ignore it if I want to, the racism in this country. I have that privilege, but I don't want that privilege. I want to have equity for everyone. So that's what I'm hoping, is that people will be able to also see that we need to ally with each other. And also within the different marginalized groups that we have in this country, that they include us with disabilities into their work. Because, again, you said change is hard, and it is. And so people who are already marginalized see and feel the hardness of things. And they look at disability, like including us, this is just from my perspective of things, as a hard thing to do, to include us. And it isn't that hard to include us. And so many people with disabilities that are a part of the different groups are left out of those groups. And And we really would be so much more powerful if we were in it together.
Well, and I think that's a great point. A lot of times it's simple fixes. And I think we're often have blinders up, or we think of it as that, oh, if we're going to make this change, it has to be this monumental change. And that's going to take a lot of work, and it's going to take all of this, you know, whether it's changes in legislature, it's changes in the work environment, it's changes in this, when it can be as simple as putting a ramp in and providing access, or offering at least one accessible, you know, bathroom. I think it's oftentimes change is hard, but let's figure out the changes that are possible and right. that can be accomplished, as opposed to saying, oh my goodness, we've got to tear down this whole building and start again because, you know, this one thing is off. But I think if we continue to strive forward, and that kind of leads me into the next thing that I kind of would like to bring into, because we're at a very critical time right now in terms of the Paralympic movement here in the U.S., and we are gaining so much momentum in terms of the visibility and what we are, you know, able to accomplish here in the U.S. I mean, when I started in Paralympic sports 21 years ago, I mean, I didn't know what Paralympic sports was. It wasn't, I mean, yes, I was in Montana, but there wasn't that visibility, whereas now we're seeing advertising with Paralympic athletes. We're seeing Paralympics in the news media. And I think we are, I think one of the greatest things, and you're a part of this with LA 28, is what we can do between right now and hosting the games in, it seems like so far off in nine years, but it's really the way not the quads far. Go and the way the games go. It seems like it's, you know, not that far away, but I'm really excited. And you have such a vital part of the LA 28 games in vice chair of.
Yeah, it was the bid. I was vice chair of the bid to bring the games to Los Angeles. So I had the opportunity to really be at the forefront of learning about actually how that happens, yeah. you know, with the IOC and right. the IPC and all the nuances that go with that. And also how the Paralympic narrative really hasn't been built into the fabric of that piece, bidding. And then, I mean, now we have a contract with the IOC and the IPC that any city that bids for the games will put on the Olympics and the Paralympics, which is not something that was in the past. I mean, my first Paralympic Games was in 1980. And in 1980, we were just beginning to have that conversation of in the same venues, in the same city, after the Olympic Games would be the Paralympic Games. Well, that year, the games were in Moscow. And the Soviets said they didn't have any disabled people. So they weren't going to hold the Paralympics. Yeah, right? Forever, people with disabilities were either put in institutions or destroyed. And we really only started coming out in the mid-20th century of institutions. Mm-hmm. And so where we are now with that contract is really cool because it says, if you do this, you will do this. And I like to think that when a city holds the games, there's inclusion and access almost by osmosis.
Right.
Now, because.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? They're going to have the Paralympic Games, so they have to think about this. They do, even if they've never thought about it.
Right. And it's such a great opportunity to really showcase and emphasize. I know in Tokyo, for the games next year, they're saying that they didn't have enough accessible hotel rooms and this and that. And so it really puts emphasis on a greater issue within a country and brings focus to an area that needs to be changed or updated. And so it's really incredible to see how, you know, bringing a games and hosting a games, yes, there's the sports and there's the fun and there's the rivalry and competition, which is all great. But it's really been impactful to see, especially in the last couple games, of how much it can, when done correctly, how much it can change a community and a country and an area that they put the Olympic and Paralympic venues in, and really how much it can revitalize an area. I happened to be just in London for the World Championships for swimming, and I was there in 2012 as working on staff, And it was so exciting to see. We went and found the village and walked around it. And it's full of life and it's packed with stores. And I mean, unless you knew that that's what the village was, you wouldn't know any different because it's such a great area and they've really changed the
East End.
The East End, which mm-hmm. which is incredible to see. And I think as we continue to move forward, it gives an opportunity to for cities that host the games to really put emphasis on changes that need to happen. I know this is people of LA are talking about transportation issues, you know, so can we provide that better and more efficiently? And so it gives, I think, a lot of ways a stepping stone or a starting point of a conversation that may be far more bigger than the games, but it at least is bringing notice to those areas and can really help out the communities mm-hmm. at which they go in. But I mean, personally, I'm so excited that we're going to be hosting another games here in the U.S.
Yeah,
I was a little young for Atlanta, but I still watched, you know, on TV. And so I'm so stoked. But I'm also super excited for how much it's going to change the way we look at athletes and people with impairments and how much we're going to see, you know, more inclusion. And I mean, we're already starting to see it, but it's going to be a lot easier is, I guess, what I'm hoping mm-hmm. in terms of, you know, when a parent has a child with a disability or an adult has an injury that leads to a disability, you know, they're not going to have to do all the research to figure out what their options are, but they can say, hey, I'm going to go play basketball at the gym down the street because I can.
Right.
And so that's a lot of the positive things that I look forward to in the next couple of years.
Well, and the social impact, you're so right. The social impact of sport is massive. And the social impact of Paralympic sport is extraordinary if we're able to put it together. The thing they did and the thing we all need to do is educate. We need to educate absolutely. Around the experience of disability and also what it takes to be able to create inclusion and have those voices, all the voices. I mean, there's some things about, oh, you know, we need a seat at the table and a voice and all these things. And I'm a super fan of the Coakley-verse. And those who know what that means. But Patrick Coakley said something to me once is, we need to build a new table, right? Everybody needs a seat at the table. We need new voices at the table. But we need to build a new table.
Yeah.
And it needs to look different. And that's my hope for Paralympic sport, for LA 2028, for just the movement of access, inclusion, and equity for all people, is that we build this new table that creates an opportunity for everyone to come in just as they want to authentically and be able to bring forward what their narrative is and that it's considered without prejudice, you know, without a judgment, and that we continue to do it with compassion and kindness and bring that forward because I think now in this world that we have, I think that there's a really cool opportunity for sport to raise and elevate that kind of voice. And it's been doing it, I think, again, like we talked about osmosis sort mm-hmm. of, but I think with intention and really good education and then the people that have something to say brought forward and put in leadership. I think that we as human beings can create an environment in the world that's going to be a place where people want to be.
Yeah.
Right?
And I mean, education, it's such a big thing. But if we can get into the schools and we can show kids from an early age, you know, I think a lot of times we get the points, the stairs, the this or that, but it's from kids, it's curiosity because if I'm not exposed to it, how do I know about it?
Exactly.
And I think that's one of the great opportunities that I see happening in a lot of school and educational mm-hmm. systems is that they're bringing Paralympic or adaptive sports into schools so that kids can see it and see how much fun it is and see how different and yet at the same time very similar it is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, kids are the future, but if we can educate young and then that empowers them to be able to make, you know, decisions and help lead.
Yeah.
It's really incredible to see and realize that we all have a stake in the game, no matter if we're able-bodied, disabled, you name it, but mm-hmm. everybody has their part.
Well, and, you know, I teach understanding disability courses, and I have a program that I put in the schools called Disability to Possibility. And I'll tell you, every single time I teach this stuff, we get about a third way into it, and people start disclosing their own disabilities they've been hiding. And it removes some of the shame and the feelings of isolation that people have. And I totally agree with you that education and in the schools is so important. And I'm really looking forward to the future. And oh my gosh, this has been such a conversation. It could go on and on.
It really could. No, so I've enjoyed this. I've
enjoyed getting to know you.
Yeah, and we've hit so many key issues that I think are such a part of not only sport, but I mean, here in the U.S. of what athletes are facing. So this has been awesome.
It's been a great conversation. And you know, I'm 65, you're 34. I mean, you are a young leadership that is going to take us to that next elevation. And I'm so looking forward to all of it and just sharing any mentorship I can.
Yes, absolutely.
And
thank you.
This has been great.